demonstration. you need. Tell me what you want to be. What you will and what you won't. A bitter pill.
You got the only love left. Hey, so brother, get a loser, that feeling, then don't stop. Cause a woman got to use what she got. Don't get what you want. Hey! Hey! Hot pants! Now look, hot pants won't make you dance, but as slick as you are, you make the pants.
Et poésie, ben vous allez rire, j'ose pas y dire. Quoi, te moques pas comme ça d'un vieil ami qui désespère, mais qui espère aussi. Un petit miracle, un petit miracle qui me rendrait de moi, mon copain, je suis dans la embarras, je sais pas quoi faire de mes mains quand elle est là. Ouais, ouais mon vieux, je regarde mes souliers et je me mets à bégayer. Aide-moi, oui, si t'es gentil, déplace-toi et viens, viens ici, viens, viens. Tu fais elle et moi je fais moi. Et si c'est bien, dis-le-moi, d'accord? Assieds-toi là, tiens. D'accord? Alors toi tu fais elle et moi je fais moi, d'accord? Toi tu fais ma fiancée. Toi tu fais ma fiancée et moi je fais moi, d'accord? Vous pouvez pas savoir comme elle est jolie. Elle a de longs cheveux blonds, des grandes boucles. Elle est mignonne, elle est extra. Tu dirais comme ça, tu m'aides, hein? Alors tu m'aides, hein? Attends, il y a des poussières, tu m'aides. Tu m'aides, hein? Je vous aime un peu beaucoup à la folie. Qu'est-ce que t'en penses?
Bah t'as une chance, oui.
Vos petites papates ont des étoiles au bout des doigts. Oh. Et votre taille au champ des femmes.
Un petit tout petit tout petit miracle. Un petit tout petit tout petit miracle.
Mademoiselle, s'il vous plaît, embrassez-moi. Comme ça, reste là, bouge pas. Vous êtes légère comme un camion de confetti. J'en perds la tête.
Arrête, arrête, non, dis.
Je vous veux de long en large, du haut en bas.
Quel gourmand.
Et ces bouclettes, et ces petites fossettes, à qui c'est tout ça?
À moi. Un petit, tout petit, tout petit miracle. Un petit, tout petit, tout petit miracle. Un petit, tout petit miracle comme ça.
Mademoiselle, voulez-vous être la maman de tous mes petits?
Oui.
Me faire la lessive.
Oui.
Me faire la cuisine.
Oui.
Aussi.
Oui. Oui. Oui.
Tu crois?
Oui.
Vraiment?
Oui.
Que mon programme?
Oui.
Lui plaira?
Non. À moi qui se passe, à moi qui se passe.
Se voir.
Tout petit, tout petit miracle. Tout petit, tout petit miracle. Tout petit, tout petit miracle. Comme ça, et pour moi.
Un petit, tout petit miracle. Un petit, tout petit, tout petit miracle. Un petit, tout petit miracle pour moi.
Now, The Stoker, a fragment. 16-year-old Carl Rossmann had been sent to America by his poor parents because a maid had seduced him. Giving birth to his child, and as his ship, which was already slowing down, sailed into the harbor of New York, he viewed the statue of the Goddess of Freedom, which he had already observed long ago, but now saw as if in a suddenly more intense sunlight. Her arm with its sword towered as if for the first time, and the free breezes wafted around her figure. "So high," he said to himself, and, not really giving any thought to disembarking, he was gradually pushed further and further, all the way to the railing, by the constantly swelling throng of porters trudging past him. A young man with whom he had become casually acquainted during the voyage said as he walked by, "Hey, don't you feel like going ashore yet?" "Oh, I'm quite ready," said Carl, smiling at him. And in his exuberance, Carl, being a strong boy, heaved his valise upon his shoulder. However, looking beyond his acquaintance, who, lightly swinging his cane, was already moving off with the others, Carl realized, to his dismay, that he had forgotten his umbrella down below. After hastily asking his acquaintance, who didn't seem very happy about the prospect, to be kind enough to watch his valise for an instant, Carl checked his surroundings in order to regain his bearings when returning, and then hurried off. Down below he found, to his regret, that a corridor that would have considerably shortened his path was barred for the first time, probably because all the passengers were disembarking, so that he arduously had to seek his way through countless small rooms, over endless series of short staircases, along ever-twisting corridors, across an empty room with a deserted desk, until he was thoroughly lost, for he had taken this route only once or twice before, and always in a large group. Bewildered as he was, encountering no one, hearing only the endless shuffling of the thousands of human feet overhead, noticing from afar, like a puff of air, the final wheeze of the engines, which had already been turned off, he began to knock without reflecting on a small door where he had happened to pause in his wanderings. "It's unlocked," someone called from inside, and Carl, with a genuine sigh of relief, opened the door. "Why are you banging so wildly on the door?" a gigantic man asked, barely glancing at Carl. Through some sort of hatch, a dim light which had been used up long since on the upper decks of the ship oozed into the miserable cabin, where a bed, a closet, a chair, and a man were jammed in side by side, as if in storage. "I've lost my way," said Carl. "I didn't realize it during the crossing, but this is an awfully huge ship." "Right you are," said the man, somewhat proudly, but he didn't stop fiddling with the lock of a small satchel, which he kept squeezing shut with both hands in order to hear the bolt snap into place. "Oh, why don't you come in?" the man went on. "You don't want to stand outside, do you?" "Am I intruding?" asked Carl. "Why, how could you intrude?" "Are you German?" Carl tried to reassure himself further, for he had heard a great deal about the dangers threatening newcomers in America, especially from Irishmen.
Yes, indeed," said the man.
Carl still hesitated, whereupon the man, unexpectedly, grabbed the doorknob and quickly shut the door, sweeping Carl inside.
"I can't stand having people peer in from the corridor," said the man, fiddling with his trunk again. "They all hurry by and peer in. There are few people who can stand that."
"But the corridor is totally deserted," said Carl, uncomfortably squashed against the bedpost.
"Yes, now," said the man.
"But this is now," thought Carl. "This man is hard to talk to."
"Why don't you lie down on the bed?" said the man. "You'll have more room."
Carl crawled in as well as he could, guffawing at his first useless effort to swing into the bed. But no sooner was he in it than he cried, "Good Lord, I've forgotten all about my valise."
"Where is it?"
"Up on deck. An acquaintance is watching it. Now just what was his name?" And from a secret pocket that his mother had sewn into his coat lining specifically for his voyage, he fished out a visiting card. "Butterbaum. Franz Butterbaum."
"Do you really need your valise?"
"Of course."
"Well, then why did you hand it over to a complete stranger?"
"I'd forgotten my umbrella below, and I hurried to get it. But I didn't want to drag along my valise. Then, to top it all off, I lost my way."
"Are you alone? No one accompanying you?"
"Yes, alone." "Maybe I should stick with this man," Carl pondered. "Where could I find a better friend?"
"And now you've lost your valise in the bargain, not to mention your umbrella."
And the man sat down on the chair as if he were developing some interest in Carl's problem. "But I don't believe my valise is lost."
"Faith can move mountains," said the man, vigorously scratching his short, dark, thick hair. "On a ship, morals change with ports of call. In Hamburg, Butterbaum might have guarded your valise, but here there's most likely no trace of either him or it."
"Then I'll have to take a look right now," said Carl,
peering around to see how he could leave.
"Stay where you are," said the man, and pushed Carl's chest with one hand, roughly shoving him back into the bed.
"But why?" asked Carl in annoyance.
"Because it makes no sense," said the man. "I'm leaving very soon, and then we can go together. Either the valise has been stolen, then there's nothing you can do, or the man's still guarding it, in which case he's a fool and should keep on guarding it, or he's simply an honest person and has left the valise there, and it will be easier to find once the ship has emptied out. And the same goes for your umbrella."
"Do you know your way around the ship?" asked Carl distrustfully, feeling as if there were some hidden catch to the otherwise persuasive idea that things could best be found when the ship was empty.
"Well, I am a stoker," said the man.
"You're a stoker?" cried Carl in delight, as if this news were beyond all expectation. And propping himself on his elbow, he took a closer look at the man. "Why, outside the room where I was sleeping with the Slovak, there was a portal through which you could see into the engine room."
"Yes, that's where I worked," said the stoker.
"I've always been interested in technology," said Carl, hewing to a specific train of thought, "and I'm certain I would have eventually become an engineer if I hadn't had to leave for America."
"But why did you have to leave?"
"Oh, well," said Carl, waving off the whole business, whereby he smiled at the stoker as if asking his indulgence even for the things he had not confessed.
"I'm sure you had your reason," said the stoker, and there was no telling whether he was demanding or dismissing the story behind that reason.
"Now I could be a stoker, too," said Carl. "My parents don't care what becomes of me."
"My job is free," said the stoker,
and in full awareness of that circumstance, he put his hands into the pockets of his creased, leather-like, iron-gray trousers and flung his legs across the bed in order to stretch them. Carl had to squeeze closer to the wall. "You're leaving the ship?"
"Yes, we're marching off today."
"But why don't you like it?"
"Well, that's how things have worked out. It's not always a matter of liking or not liking something. Besides, you're right, I don't like it. You're probably not seriously thinking of becoming a stoker, but that's precisely the easiest way to become one. So I would strongly advise you against it. If you wanted to study in Europe, why not do it here? The American universities are incomparably better than the European ones."
"It's certainly possible," said Carl. "But I have almost no money to go to school. I did read about someone who worked in a shop during the day and studied at night until he got a doctorate, and I think he became a mayor, but that takes a lot of perseverance, don't you think? I'm afraid that's something I lack. Anyway, I was never a particularly good student. It wasn't really hard for me to leave high school. And the high schools here may be more demanding. I hardly speak a word of English. And anyway, I think people here are so prejudiced against foreigners."
"Have you come up against such prejudice? Well, that's good. Then you're my man. Look, we're on a German ship. It belongs to the Hamburg-America line. So why aren't we all Germans here? Why is the chief engineer a Romanian? His name is Schubel. Why, it's beyond belief, and that scoundrel makes us Germans work like dogs on a German ship. You mustn't think—"
He was out of breath and waving his hand. "That I'm complaining just to complain. I know you have no influence. You're a poor little fellow yourself, but it's really awful." And he banged his fist on the table several times, never removing his eyes from his fist while banging.
"Why, I've worked on so many ships."
And he reeled off 20 names as if they were a single word, totally confusing Carl.
"And I've always done an excellent job. I was praised. All the captains were pleased with my work, and I even spent several years on one cargo ship."
He stood up as if that had been the high point of his life.
"And here on this tub, where everything is done strictly by the book, where no intelligence is required, here I'm worthless. I'm always in Schubal's way. I'm a lazy good-for-nothing. I deserve to be tossed out on my ear, and they're doing me a big favor by paying me. Do you understand? I don't." You shouldn't put up with that, said Carl, all worked up. He felt so much at home here, on the stoker's bed, that he had practically lost all sense of being on the precarious bottom of a ship off the coast of an unknown continent. Have you gone to the captain? Have you tried to obtain justice from him?
Oh, come on, you'd better leave. I don't want you here. You don't listen to what I say, and then you dish out advice. How can I go to the captain?
And the stoker wearily sat down again, burying his face in his hands. I can't give him any better advice, Carl thought to himself. And on the whole, he felt he should have gone after his valise rather than stay here and give advice. It was simply considered stupid. When his father had handed him the valise for good, he had jokingly asked, "How long will you hold on to it?" And now this precious valise might seriously be lost. Carl's only comfort was that his father could scarcely find out about his current situation, even if he made inquiries. The shipping line would only be able to report that Carl had sailed as far as New York. However, he was sorry that he had barely used the articles in the valise, even though he ought to have, say, changed his shirt long ago. Thus he had economized in the wrong place. Now, at the very start of his career, when he would have needed to wear clean clothes, he would have to appear in a dirty shirt. Otherwise, the loss of the valise would not have been so bad, for the suit he had on was actually better than the one in the valise, which was just an emergency suit that his mother had hastily mended right before his departure. Now he also remembered that the valise contained a piece of Verona salami, which his mother had packed as an extra treat, of which, however, he had managed to eat only the smallest scrap, since he had had absolutely no appetite during the voyage. And the soup distributed in steerage had been quite enough for him. But now he would have been glad to have the salami at hand so he could present it to the stoker. For such people are easily won over if you slip them some trifle or other. Carl had learned that from his father, who, by handing out cigars, won over all the lower-level employees with whom he dealt in business. Now the only thing that Carl could give away was his money. But he did not care to touch it for the time being, since he might have already lost his valise. Again his thoughts turned back to the valise, and he really could not see why he had guarded it so vigilantly during the passage that it had practically cost him his sleep. If he had now let this selfsame valise be taken away from him so easily. He recalled the 5 nights during which he had unabatingly suspected a short Slovak, who lay 2 bunks to his left, of being after his valise. This Slovak had merely been lying in wait for Carl to be overcome with drowsiness and finally nod off for a moment so that he, the Slovak, could pull the valise over with a long pole with which he kept playing or practicing throughout the day. In the daytime, this Slovak looked innocent enough, but once the night had come, he would get up from his bed from time to time and peer sadly at Carl's valise. Carl could make him out quite clearly, for every so often someone, with the uneasiness of an immigrant, would light a small candle, although thereby flouting the shipboard rules, and try to decipher the unintelligible brochures of the immigration companies. If such a candle was burning nearby, then Carl could doze off a little. But if the light was far away, or the hold was dark, then he had to keep his eyes open. The strain had thoroughly exhausted him, and now it may have been all for nothing. Oh, that Butterbaum, if ever he ran into him somewhere. At that instant, brief thuds could be heard in the distance, breaking into the utter hush like the footsteps of children coming closer and growing louder until they sounded like the quiet marching of men. They were apparently walking in single file, which was natural in the narrow corridor, and a rattling as if of weapons could be heard. Carl, who had been on the verge of stretching out in bed and drifting into a sleep that would be free of all worries about valises and Slovaks, jumped up and nudged the stoker in order to warn him finally, for the head of the procession seemed to have just reached the door.
"That's the ship's band," said the stoker. "They've played on deck, and now they're coming to pack up. Everything is clear now. We can go. Come on."
He grabbed Carl's hand. At the last moment, he took a framed picture of the Madonna from the wall over the bed, stuffed the image into his breast pocket, grabbed his suitcase, and hurried out of the cabin with Carl.
"I'm heading straight for the office now, and I'm going to give those gentlemen a piece of my mind. There are no passengers left, so I don't have to pull any punches."
The stoker kept repeating this in various ways, and while walking along, he kicked out sideways, trying to stamp down on a rat that scurried across his path. But he merely drove it faster into the hole, which it managed to reach in the nick of time. He was generally slow in his movements, for while his legs were long, they were also very clumsy. Carl and the stoker walked through a section of the kitchen where several girls in dirty aprons, they were deliberately splashing them, were washing dishes in huge tubs. The stoker called over a girl named Lena, put his arm around her waist, and pulled her along for a bit while she snuggled coquettishly against his arm.
"We're going for our pay. Wouldn't you like to come along?"
he asked. "Why bother? Just bring me the money," she replied, squirming out from under his arm and hurrying off.
"Where did you pick up that handsome boy?" she called back, but without waiting for an answer.
They heard the laughter of all the other girls who had paused in their work. However, Carl and the stoker kept walking until they came to a door under a small pediment resting on small gilded caryatids. It looked quite lavish for a decor on a ship. Carl realized he had never been in this area, which had probably been reserved for first and second class passengers during the voyage, while now, right before the major overhauling of the ship, the dividing doors had been unhinged. They had also run into several men who, carrying brooms on their shoulders, had greeted the stoker. Carl was astonished at the vast workings of the ship. In steerage he had, of course, witnessed little of that. Furthermore, the wires of electric lines ran along the corridors and a small bell kept ringing incessantly. The stoker knocked respectfully on the door, and when a voice called, "Come in," he motioned to Carl not to be afraid and to go in. Carl did go in, but remained standing at the door. Through the three windows of the room he saw the ocean waves, and as he watched their cheerful movements, his heart pounded as though he had not been looking at the ocean uninterruptedly for 5 long days. Huge ships were passing one another, yielding to the breakers only to the extent that their weight permitted. If you squinted, those ships seemed to be staggering under their own weight. Their masts sported narrow but lengthy pennants that, while stiffened by the ship's motion, kept flapping to and fro. Salutes boomed, probably from men of war. One such battleship was sailing by not too far away, and the reflections shone on the steel gun barrels, which were virtually coddled by the sure, smooth and yet not level gliding of the ship. From the door, the small skiffs and boats could be seen only in the distance as swarms of them nosed into the gaps between the huge vessels. But beyond all that loomed New York, peering at Carl with the 100,000 windows of its skyscrapers. Yes, indeed. In this room, you knew where you were. 3 gentlemen were sitting at a round table. One of them, a ship's officer in a blue maritime uniform. The 2 others, officials of the Port Authority, in black American uniforms. On the table lay high stacks of various documents, which the officer first skimmed, pen in hand, then passed on to the 2 others, who read them, made excerpts, and then stowed them away in their briefcases, unless the one official, almost perpetually clicking his teeth, dictated something to his colleague, who recorded it. By one window a small man sat at a desk, keeping his back to the door while fiddling with huge, ponderous ledgers that were lined up on a sturdy shelf in front of his head. Next to him lay an open strong box which looked empty, at least at first glance. The 2nd window, being vacant, offered the best view. But at the 3rd window, stood two gentlemen conversing in low voices. One of them, leaning against the window, was likewise wearing a maritime uniform and playing with a hilt of the sword. The man he was speaking with was facing the window, and occasionally his movements exposed a portion of the row of decorations on the other man's chest. Dressed in civilian attire, he was holding a thin bamboo cane, which, since both his hands were on his hips, likewise stuck out like a sword. Carl did not have much time to take in everything, for an attendant promptly came over to them, and with a glance that told the stoker he did not belong here, the attendant asked him what he wanted. Answering as softly as he had been asked, the stoker said he wished to speak to the purser. The attendant, for his part, waved off this request, but nevertheless, giving wide berth to the round table, he tiptoed over to the man with the ledgers. This man, it was plain to see, simply froze at the attendant's words, but finally turned toward the man who wished to speak to him, and vehemently warding him off, he gesticulated toward the stoker, and also, to make sure, toward the attendant. The latter thereupon returned to the stoker and said, as if confiding something, "Get out of this room at once." At this response, the stoker looked down at Carl as if the boy were his heart, to which he was mutely bewailing his woe. Not giving it a second thought, Carl lunged forward and charged straight across the room, brushing against the officer's chair. The attendant dashed after him, hulking forward with outspread arms, ready to tackle as if chasing some sort of vermin. But Carl beat him to the purser's desk, which he gripped hard in case the attendant tried to pull him away. Naturally, the entire room burst into life. The ship's officer at the table leaped up. The port officials watched calmly but attentively. The two gentlemen at the window moved close together. The attendant, feeling it was not his place to interfere now that his superiors were showing interest, stepped back. The stoker, at the door, waited nervously for the moment when his help would be needed. The purser, in his armchair, finally made a broad turn to the right. Reaching into his secret pocket, which he had no qualms about exposing to these people, Carl pulled out his passport, opened it, and placed it upon the desk in lieu of further introduction. The purser seemed to regard the passport as irrelevant, for he flicked it aside with two fingers, whereupon Carl repocketed it as if this formality had been concluded satisfactorily. "Permit me to say," he then began, "that in my opinion, the stoker has been treated unjustly. There is a man named Shubal here who has it in for him. The stoker himself has worked on many ships, all of which he can list for you, and his performance has always been completely satisfactory. He is diligent, has a good attitude toward his job, and it is hard to see why he should fall short on this particular ship, where the work is not so exceedingly difficult as, say, on merchant vessels. It can therefore only be slander that interferes with his advancement, depriving him of the recognition that would otherwise quite certainly be his. I am outlining this matter in only the most general terms. He will submit his specific grievances to you himself." Carl had addressed his statements to all the gentlemen because all of them were, in fact, listening. And it seemed far likelier that a just man could be found among them rather than that this just man would turn out to be the purser. Moreover, Carl had been artful enough not to mention that he had first met the stoker only a very short while ago. On the whole, he would have spoken far more effectively had he not been disconcerted by the red face of the man with the bamboo cane upon first seeing that face from his present vantage point. "Every single word is correct," said the stoker, before anyone had so much as asked. Indeed, before anyone had so much as glanced in his direction. The stoker's over-eagerness would have been a great mistake if the man with the decorations, who, as it now dawned on Carl, was obviously the captain, had not clearly made up his mind to hear what the stoker had to say. For the captain held out his hand and called to the stoker, "Come here," in a voice that was so solid it could have been hit with a hammer. Now, Everything hung on the stoker's conduct, for Carl did not doubt that his grievance was just. Fortunately, the stoker, as it turned out, was not born yesterday. With exemplary composure, he reached into his satchel and, at the first try, produced a small bundle of papers and a notebook. Then, as if it were the most natural thing in the world, he walked over to the captain, thoroughly ignoring the purser, and spread out his evidence on the windowsill. The purser had no choice. He had to go to the bother of joining him there. "This man is a known grumbler," the purser said by way of explanation. "He spends more time in the teller's office than in the engine room. Shubal is a very peaceable man, but he has driven him to utter distraction. Now listen," he turned to the stoker. "You are really getting much too pushy. How often have you been thrown out of the teller's offices? And it served you right with your demands, which are completely, entirely, and consistently unjustified. How often have you gone running from there to the purser's office? How often have you been patiently informed that Shubal is your immediate superior, with whom you must find some way of coming to terms yourself? And now you actually have the nerve to come here when the captain himself is present, and you do not even think twice about pestering him. Indeed, you actually have the effrontery to bring along this boy whom you have trained as the mouthpiece of your nonsensical accusations, and yet this is the first time I have ever seen him on this ship." Carl mustered all his self-control to keep from jumping forward. However, the captain was already intervening. "Why don't we hear what the man has to say? Besides, Shubal's becoming far too independent for my taste, which, however, does not mean that I am taking your part." Those latter words were addressed to the stoker. It was quite natural that the captain could not instantly side with him, but everything seemed to be moving in the right direction. The stoker launched into his explanations, pulling himself together at the very start by referring to Shubal as Mr. Shubal. How delighted Carl was, standing at the purser's vacant desk, where he took such pleasure in repeatedly pressing down on a postal scale. Mr. Shubal was unfair. Mr. Shubal gave preference to foreigners. Mr. Shubal had ordered the stoker out of the engine room and made him clean toilets, which were certainly not part of his job. At one point, Mr. Shubal's capabilities were challenged as supposedly more bogus than real. At this juncture, Carl stared at the captain with all his might, unabashedly, as if the two of them were colleagues, simply so the captain would not be unfavorably influenced by the stoker's awkward way of expressing himself. Still, nothing substantial was gleaned from the stoker's outpourings, and even though the captain kept gazing straight ahead, his eyes revealing his determination to hear the stoker out this time, the other gentlemen were growing impatient, and soon the stoker's voice no longer unrestrictedly dominated the room, which was a cause of some concern for Carl. First, the gentleman in civilian attire began wielding his bamboo cane, tapping it, albeit softly, on the floor. The other gentlemen, of course, glanced over now and then. But the two port officials, who were obviously in a hurry, reached for their files again and started going through them, if still somewhat absently. The ship's officer moved closer to his desk, and the purser, believing he had carried the day, heaved a deep, ironic sigh. Only the attendant seemed to be free of the generally developing indifference. Sympathetic to the sufferings of the poor man confronting the great, he earnestly nodded at Carl as if trying to explain something. Meanwhile, the hubbub in the harbor continued outside the windows. A barge glided by, almost darkening the room with a mountain of barrels, which must have been marvelously stowed since none of them rolled about. Small motorboats, which Carl, had he now had time, could have carefully scrutinized, roared by dead straight, obeying the jerking hands of a man standing erect at the wheel. Now and then some peculiar piece of flotsam surfaced on its own from the restless water and was promptly swallowed up, sinking before Carl's astonished eyes. Crowded boats belonging to the ocean liners were being rowed along by fiercely working sailors and were full of passengers who sat there exactly as they had been squeezed in, quiet and expectant, although some could not help turning their heads to look at the changing scenery. A ceaseless movement, an agitation transmitted from the agitated element to helpless human beings and their works. But everything urged haste, clarity, very precise description. Yet what did the stoker do? He was talking himself into a sweat. His trembling hands had long since been unable to hold the papers on the windowsill. Complaints about Shubal came pouring into his mind from all directions, and in his opinion, any one of them would have sufficed to bury that Shubal completely. Yet all he could offer the captain was a dismal hodgepodge. For a long time now, the man with the bamboo cane had been faintly whistling toward the ceiling. The port officials were already keeping the officer at their desk and showing no sign of ever letting him go. The purser was visibly held back from horning in only by the captain's calm demeanor. The attendant, standing at attention, expected the captain to issue an order about the stoker at any moment. Carl could no longer remain inactive. He walked slowly toward the group and, while walking, reflected all the more quickly on how to handle this business as deftly as possible. It was certainly high time, a bit longer, and both of them could very well be tossed out of the office. The captain might be a good man, and might also at this very moment, as it seemed to Carl, have some special reason for acting as a fair superior. But ultimately, he was no instrument that one could play into the ground, and that was precisely how the stoker was treating him, although out of a profound sense of utter indignation. So, Carl said to the stoker, "You have to express yourself more simply, more clearly. The captain can't appreciate what you say if you talk to him like that. Does he know all the mechanics and cabin boys by their last names, much less Christian names, so that if you just mention a name, he instantly realizes whom you're talking about? Sort your grievances out clearly. Give him the most important ones first, and then the others in descending order. Perhaps then you won't even need to articulate most of them. You've always presented everything to me so lucidly." If people can steal a valise in America, then you can also lie now and then, he thought to himself, by way of excuse. If only it could help. Might it not be too late by now? The stoker did instantly break off upon hearing that familiar voice, but his eyes were so blinded with tears of wounded manly honor, terrible memories, and extreme current distress, that he couldn't even properly recognize Carl. How should he now, and Carl silently realized this upon seeing the now silent stoker, how should he now abruptly change his style of speaking, since he did feel that he had said everything there was to say, but without receiving the slightest acknowledgement, and that he had, on the other hand, said nothing as yet and couldn't expect these gentlemen to hear him out? At this point, Carl, his sole champion, had stepped in, trying to give him some sound advice, yet instead had shown him that everything, absolutely everything, was lost. If only I had come forward sooner instead of looking out the window, Carl thought to himself, lowering his head in front of the stoker and folding his hands on the seam of his trousers to signal the end of all hope. But the stoker misunderstood, thinking most likely that Carl was secretly reproaching him. And with the good intention of disabusing him, the stoker crowned all his previous actions by starting to argue with Carl. Now that the gentlemen at the round table had long since grown indignant at the senseless racket that was disrupting their important work, now that the purser, gradually at a loss to comprehend the captain's patience, was about to explode, now that the attendant, fully back within the sphere of his superiors, was glowering savagely at the stoker, and now that the man with the bamboo cane, at whom even the captain was occasionally darting friendly glances, was completely indifferent to, even repelled by, the stoker, and, pulling out a small notebook and apparently occupied with entirely different matters, kept glancing back and forth between the notebook and Carl. I know, said Carl, who had trouble warding off the stoker's torrent, yet managed to keep up a friendly smile for him through all the arguing. You're right. I've never once doubted it. For fear of getting hit, Carl would have liked to hold the stoker's gesticulating hands, or even, to be sure, urge him into a corner and whisper a few quiet, soothing words that no one else need hear. But the stoker was beside himself. Carl now began drawing some measure of comfort from the thought that if push came to shove, the stoker would overwhelm all the seven men present with the sheer strength of his despair. However, as a glance instructed Carl, the desk had a panel with far too many buttons for the electric line, and if a hand simply pressed down on it, the entire ship, with its corridors full of hostile men, could turn rebellious. Now the so uninterested gentleman with the bamboo cane stepped over to Carl and asked, not too loudly, yet audibly enough through all the stoker's ravings, "Just what is your name?" At that moment someone knocked, as if he had been waiting behind the door for the man to say those very words. The attendant looked at the captain, who nodded. And so the attendant went over to the door and opened it. Outside, wearing an old military coat, stood a man of medium height who, to judge by his appearance, did not really seem suitable for working on the engines, and yet this was Schubel. If Carl had not understood this from everyone's eyes, which all expressed a certain satisfaction of which not even the captain was free, then he, to his horror, would have inferred it by looking at the stoker, who clenched his fists so vehemently on his rigid arms as if this clenching were the most important thing in the world, something to which he was willing to sacrifice his last ounce of life. All his strength was concentrated in his fists, including the strength that kept him on his feet. And so, here was the enemy, free and fresh, in festive garb, with a ledger under his arm, probably the stoker's payroll information and work papers, and with the fearless intention of trying, above all,